What happens when your face becomes a problem before you even open your mouth? When success doesn't protect you from erasure and invisibility doesn't shield you from violence? This exploration of Asian American consciousness begins not with triumph, but with a phantom, an imaginary facial tic that consumed an accomplished poet despite having no physical basis. Living in a beautiful New York loft, book completed, life seemingly assembled, yet feeling like a sloth that fell from its tree. The search for help led to the one Korean-American therapist in network, someone who might understand without translation. After an emotional consultation ending in tears, the therapist rejected her as a patient. No explanation, just cold professionalism and the door closing. This rejection wasn't merely personal. It crystallized a lifetime of proving oneself into existence while simultaneously dissolving, working five times harder while watching confidence evaporate from conditional love and a society treating you as interchangeable as lint. Asian Americans occupy a peculiar purgatory, neither white enough nor black enough, distrusted by some, ignored by others. We're carpenter ants in service industries, corporate workers who never reach leadership because we lack the right face. Racial self-hatred means seeing yourself through white eyes, becoming your own worst enemy, resenting other Asians in the room because boundaries congeal into a horde rather than solidarity. This is the architecture of what gets called minor feelings, racialized emotions that are negative, dysphoric, unintelligent, built from everyday experiences of having your perception questioned. They arise when you hear a slight, know it's racial, but get told that's all in your head. Our history reads like convenient amnesia. Chinese laborers built the Transcontinental Railroad, three dying for every 2 miles of track, yet were cropped from the Golden Spike celebration photo. The 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act banned an entire race, with legislators calling Chinese rats and machine-like job stealers. By 1917, immigration bans covered all of Asia. America only welcomed Asians back in 1965 to polish its Cold War image, promoting us as model minorities to undermine black civil rights demands. This status remains precarious. Since 9/11, hate crimes spike as white supremacists attack Sikhs and Hindus, mistaking them for Muslims. When people say Asians are next in line to be white, mentally replace white with disappear. We're listed as other in polls, hard to find in racial breakdowns. It's like being ghosted. You stop trusting what you see and hear. Your ego free falls while your superego becomes boundless, compelling you to do better, be better, blindly following America's gospel of self-interest until you vanish. The Asian American immigrant becomes the ideal neoliberal subject, accepting history's burden and working without complaint. Unlike gratitude, which exists in the present moment, indebtedness fixates anxiously on the future, treating good fortune as a loan requiring repayment through inevitable misfortune. Depression had pinned someone to the couch during a New York snowstorm when Richard Pryor appeared on the wall, 7 feet tall in red silk. His genius lay in embodying entire worlds alone, his face revealing profound woundedness even while impersonating animals. His stark confessionals showed that innocence is a privilege Black people don't experience. I was a kid until I was 8, then I became a Negro. He began imitating Bill Cosby until his Vegas epiphany, realizing his grandmother, who raised him in her brothel, wouldn't be welcome at the Aladdin Hotel. He walked off stage asking, "What the fuck am I doing here?" That moment marked when he found his authentic voice. Watching Pryor sparked a question, "Who am I writing for?" Poets claim to dismiss audience concerns, but it's a lie. We're obsessed with status and institutions. The realization hit, still writing to please white people, a desire ingrained through education. Poetry initially felt freeing because identity seemed shed, the body dematerialized. But as a published Asian female poet, that spectral presence limited how readers received the work. Stand-up offered transparency. Comedians can't pretend they don't have identities. They're exposed on stage, and audiences cannot be convinced into laughter. Shifting to stand-up felt like finally speaking in a native tongue. Youth meant observing white children's harmonious homes, unlike the tense household with witchy stenches and grandmother fertilizing the garden with her own urine. At school, feeling recessed while everyone else seemed in relief. Now, as a mother, strange memory gaps appeared during bedtime reading rituals parents never performed. The mind searches for nostalgic memories and finds none, not passing down happy memories so much as staging them. Parents' idea of providing was fundamental: food, shelter, school, as immigrants who traveled not just spatially, but temporally, three generations forward. Rather than looking back with nostalgia, the gaze went sideways with envy at white families and commercials. Scholar Catherine Bond Stockton writes how queer children and children of color grow sideways outside the model of the enshrined white child. This sideways gaze also meant suspicion, feelings toward coming-of-age novels like Catcher in the Rye that demanded identification. Holden Caulfield was just some rich prep school kid whose fixation with childhood innocence seemed alien when the goal was getting childhood over with quickly. The relationship with English has always been complicated. Born in LA, but not fluent until 6 or 7, surrounded by Korean and broken English. Profanity was the first real introduction, teaching cousins curses to prepare them for school, while an uncle learned to begin and end sentences with motherfucker from his black customers. English in the community was borrowed from hip-hop, Spanglish, and pop culture. Bad English is heritage, sharing lineage with writers who other English, who queer, twerk, hack, and warp it into a fugitive tongue, revealing the imperial power sewn into the language. At high school art camp in Maine, I felt outclassed by nihilistically hip New York kids. A tall Taiwanese goth girl in a vintage negligee intimidated everyone. When she invited me to paint together one Saturday, I accepted immediately. Making art had always been private escape. Painting alongside someone else felt uncomfortably intimate. I was self-conscious about performing the role of artist, yet paradoxically, that identity became real for the first time. As we worked, her intimidating aura evaporated. She wasn't from New York, but Long Island suburbs with strict immigrant parents like mine. Years later, at a Chelsea exhibition, I discovered her unfinished surrealist painting from art camp among amateur works collected from thrift stores. Her mother had dumped her portfolio, and artist Jim Shaw had found it. Despite my urging, she refused to claim it, embarrassed by her juvenile work. These friendships, reconnecting at Oberlin, meeting another intense artist who approached everything with passion before abandoning it, became more life-changing than conventional milestones. Our heated exchanges at diners became the foundation absorbed into my art and poetry. On November 5, 1982, artist Teresa Hak Kyung Cha left the Metropolitan Museum with her career ascending, her book Dictée newly published, an exhibition upcoming. Entering the Puck Building, she encountered security guard Joseph Sanza, a serial rapist who knew her and her husband. Because she could identify him, he raped and beat her with a nightstick, strangled her, and dumped her body near her home. First encountering Dictée at Oberlin in 1996, it spoke a language acknowledging English as an imposition on consciousness. For years, teaching her work without investigating her murder. When finally researching, scholars rarely mentioned her death or omitted the rape entirely. This silence mirrors how Asian cultures handle trauma. Stories of women who disappeared or went mad circulate without explanation. While Sylvia Plath's death generates endless analysis, Cha's personal life remains sealed. The most circulated image of Cha is actually her sister, a misidentification that troubles deeply. On good writing days, becoming the octopus devouring English before it devours you. A grandmother watched Love Connection religiously, despite not understanding English, laughing along with the laugh track, turning to check if laughter was shared. During the war, American soldiers gave the author's grandfather a tin of Charms Sour Balls after nearly shooting him. The candy's explosive flavors astonished him. American forces strategically distributed candy throughout war zones. In South Korea, hearts were won as capitalism and Christianity rose from its wrappers in devastated lands. In 1968, UC Berkeley students created Asian American as a radical political identity inspired by Black Power and anti-colonial movements. They fought domestic racism and U.S. imperialism, particularly concerned with Southeast Asian casualties. The author discovered this radical history late, having absorbed mainstream dismissals of these movements as failures or fringe. Rejecting immigrant gratitude, the author points to America's violent interventions. Two uninformed officers arbitrarily divided Korea using a National Geographic map, separating millions of families. The U.S. dropped more bombs on Korea than during the entire Pacific campaign against Japan. The author acknowledges indebtedness to activists, writers, and parents, but refuses repayment through silence or that privatized dream of taking what's mine. Asian Americans live under a softer panopticon, where belonging remains conditional. Japanese internment survivors protesting Latin American children's detention declare, "We were always here." As a poet, the author wields English as weapon against the powerful, yet falters expressing love. The love raised with was so intertwined with pain that airing it would become betrayal.